All right, so Genesis chapter 42, and we are dealing with Joseph's first meeting with his brothers. And you recall we were emphasizing, or we began to emphasize at some point last week, that this is all a part of a larger picture that's going on. And God, of course, is going to establish the Israelites as his special people, set them apart from the rest of the world, and that through and by them, the Messiah would come. And all of that began with the Abrahamic promise, the covenant that he made with him, that through him or in his seed, all families of the earth would be blessed. And that blessedness is talking primarily, at least the most important part of that Abrahamic promise, is dealing with the Messiah coming. He is the seed. Galatians chapter 3 is clear about the seed of Abraham being Christ. He said, not as of many, but as of one seed, which is Christ. And so that's the larger picture. But let's go look at this a little bit deeper with regard to why. Why did God raise up Joseph to lead Israel into Egypt? Why was that necessary? Why didn't he just do it right there where they were? Why was all of that necessary? And the reason for that, there's a couple of reasons. First of all, there was moral decay within Jacob's family. And that's a problem. Because as I just said, we understand that all of this is just getting going where the Jews would become the nation of Israel, and the Messiah would come through that family and through that lineage. So it's very important that they remain pure. And in the very beginning, they're on shaky ground because the family of Jacob is not very pure, as we have seen in our previous studies. We did not, I don't know why that thing is that color, but that's Genesis 34. But anyway, the revenge of Dinah, you remember, which resulted in the mass murder and enslavement of the whole city. Simeon and Levi were, of course, responsible for that. And I know as we went over that, we didn't spend a lot of time of that. That's kind of Genesis 34 outside the scope of our study on Joseph. But they were mass murderers is what they were. And that seems to be dramatic, but that's really not overstating it. They murdered all the men of that particular city. Remember what city it was? City of what? City of... Do we have to go back with it? No, we don't. It's Shechem, the city of Shechem. And so the whole city, I mean, what if someone murdered every male in Akron? Would that be mass murder? Of course, Shechem wasn't Akron, you know, but even what if someone murdered all the males here in the Firestone Park area? That'd be mass murder? I mean, you stop and think about it. That's what Simeon and Levi did. They killed a whole lot of men and then enslaved their wives, took their children, women and children away. That's brutal. That says something. I mean, how would we view individuals who did that to a city today? I mean, that's the kind of character that they had. Of course, we know that the hatred and selling of Joseph by their brothers, we cover that. That is a part of our story, of course. But that, again, showed the kind of character that the sons of Jacob had. And then Judah, of course, the shameful sins of Judah, that's in Genesis chapter 38, is detailed for us. And again, that's outside of our study, but that's their history. And so you can see that Jacob is not doing a great job in instilling a moral message to his family. And so the moral decay is underway, and something has to be done about that. And then you add to that, and it's kind of really all connected, but the family was being immersed in worldliness. Because there they are in Canaan. So obviously, who are they surrounded by? The Canaanites. And That's a problem. That was always a problem for Israel. Even when we jump ahead and the Jews did become a great nation, but you remember they failed to drive out the Canaanites from the land. And so God, the reason, well, you just tell me, why did God want them to drive the Canaanites out? Right. So that would be a major part of it. So they wouldn't marry those Canaanites. But in connection with that, just the overall influence of those Canaanites would be a problem for the Jews, for God's people. And of course, they failed to drive them out completely, and they became a problem. And the Jews began to be idolaters like the Canaanites around them and all of that. And so they even got to the point where some, Ahab, I believe, is one who offered his children to in sacrifice, just like the Canaanites were doing. What a terrible aspect of idolatry that is, to offer your son as a burnt offering, offer him to the fire. And that's what even the Jews started to do. So that's after they became a great nation. And can you imagine if they're in this beginning time with Jacob, when everything is just getting started, there they are surrounded by these immoral, adulterous people, and that would rub off on them. They would, as Sam said, they would be in danger if they were just left there intermarrying with the heathens and the Canaanites. In fact, when you look over at in Genesis chapter 36, we won't read this. You go down, and this is the generations of Esau. And you read all of that. Esau took wives from the Canaanites, Aden, the daughter of Elon, and so on, and then goes through all of these ones. But that's what Esau did. Is it possible that the sons of Jacob would have done the same thing? And the next thing you know, they would be integrated into the Canaanites. They lose their distinctiveness. And the whole plan that God is setting forth, that these people were to be set apart and then be his special treasure, and the Messiah would come through them, all of that would be ruined. And so, in fact, even when, look over at Genesis chapter 15. God, when he was making the promise to Abraham, the Abrahamic covenant that I talked about a few minutes ago, God realized that whole thing would be a problem. And so this was actually getting them away from the Canaanites for these years was actually his plan. And here, when he's making the promise to Abraham, Genesis 15 at verse 12, it says, as the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell on Abram. And behold, dreadful and great darkness fell upon him. And then the Lord said to Abram, know that for certain that your offspring will be sojourners in a land that is not theirs, and will be servants there, and they will be afflicted 400 years. What land is he talking about? Egypt. Egypt. So this is way back when things, again, are just getting started with Abraham, even. Before he has any children by way of Sarah, all of this. You're going to be a father of many nations. That's what he's talking about. He's talking about the time when they would go into Egypt. They would be afflicted. But now watch. As for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace. You shall be burdened in good old age, and they shall not come back here in the fourth generation, for their iniquity, the iniquity of the Amorites, is not yet complete. So you think about that. That's exactly what I'm talking about. They are. God arranged all of this. He tells Abraham they're gonna end up going to a strange land. Because the Amorites, just a part of, sometimes the Bible uses the word Canaanite to describe all of the people in that area, all that eastern coast of the Mediterranean, and all the people up and down there, all of that, sometimes that's the Canaanites, or sometimes it's more specific, like the Amorites, but that's what it's talking about. And so he's telling Abraham, your descendants are going to have to go to a strange land, be afflicted for 400 years because things weren't ready yet. And so they head to these Canaanites, these Amorites, all the people that now surround Jacob and his sons. They're there, and they haven't even reached the peak of their immorality and iniquity yet. But all of that would be developed, and that would be developed and going on while the Israelites are growing into a great multitude of people in Egypt and finally get to the point where they could be a great nation. So it's all happening together. But God, of course, knows the end from the beginning. He sees all of this playing out. That was the reason why they had to get to Egypt, to get away from the Canaanites. And that's also why it's justifiable when the Jews, after their exodus, and they go back, and then you have the conquest period, and they're going in and taking over, driving out the inhabitants. Was that just? Yes, because those inhabitants were sinful and ungodly, immoral. And so God is punishing them. At the same time, he's fulfilling the promise to the Israelites. But all of that, they had, as he says here, had to wait until their iniquity was complete, was full. And so, but that's why he had to raise up Joseph in the first place, to get the family out of there so that the Jews would be apart from the Canaanites. And then, of course, his plan, as I said earlier, was when they came back to drive out the Canaanites, that's where they dropped the ball again. They failed to do that. And they did most of that. And, of course, occupied the land. And God gave them the land, and they possessed it, all that God had promised. But the Canaanites still remained there and caused them trouble, and they ultimately had to go off into captivity and so on. But that's why all of this had to happen. And, of course, right now then, we're getting to the point where that's all being developed. God providentially worked all that out, beginning with Joseph being thrown into a pit by his brothers, and everything that developed from there. So let's go back over then to Genesis chapter 42. And we read, just to get us up, I think we're down to about verse 6. But just the first five verses says, when Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why do you look at one another?" And he said, "Behold, I have heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. Go down and buy grain for us, that we might live and not die." So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain in Egypt, but Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Thus the sons of Israel came to buy among the others who came, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. Now Joseph, verse 6, was governor over all the land. He was the one who sold to all the people of the land. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And so, again, all of this took a long time to develop, didn't it? And you may not think so, but what about Joseph? You think he did? All of the ups and downs that he has gone through, that we have seen in the text, all those years that he's suffered affliction in a strange land, all of that, and finally now, remember, the whole story began with him having a dream, having a couple of dreams in which his brothers are going to bow down to him, and then another dream, his brothers and his parents are going to bow down to him. But all those years passed, and it didn't look like that dream was going to come to fruition, did it? I mean, you're talking 20 years. It's amazing that, and one of the things we often talk about, that when it comes down to God, we have to learn to wait on the Lord, because he doesn't operate on our time schedule, does he? As much as you want him to, as much as I want him to, you know, God is timeless. We looked, I think, at the passage last week with regard to the second coming. A day to God is 1,000 years. 1,000 years like a day. And we can't We intellectually we can grasp that, but we can't really understand it. Like someone who has always been. I mean, that's God. And so a being that has no time, to him, you know, 1,000 year passes, 2,000 years passes, 4,000, whatever. That means nothing to God. He has always been. He is eternal. And so when you stop and think about that, you think, well, you know, things aren't happening for me spiritually at the pace that I want them to happen. You have to be patient. You have to learn to wait on the Lord. It was the psalmist said, our soul waits for the Lord. He is our help and our shield. Now, that help may not always come exactly when you want it to. But you have to have patience. You have to trust in God. Think about how patient Joseph was from the beginning to where we are now. Before his exhortation. He had the dream. He's thinking, you know, he's going to be somehow, some way, he's going to be in this position of authority. Even his brethren are going to bow down to him. Next thing he knows, he's in a pit. Next thing you know, he's in prison. And things are rough. And so it doesn't look like when he was a slave in Potiphar's house, did it look like his brothers were going to bow down to him? It didn't look like he'd ever see his brothers again. How in the world were they ever going to bow down to him when he's all over here in Egypt? A slave in someone's house. And then again in prison. Didn't look like. But he had patience. He waited on the Lord. He never gave up. He never wavered. And that's what it takes for us. Isaiah 40, verse 31. But they who wait for the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount up with wings of eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. But who are the they? They're those who wait on the Lord. And there's a lot of applications to that. Maybe the best application of that is in prayer. How often do you pray for something and you want the answer right now? But you have to wait. You think right away. You know, a day or two passes, a week passes. God, not going to answer this prayer. Another prayer not answered by God. Well, you wait on the Lord. You have to learn to wait. Of course, there's the application to the second coming of Christ. That's what that passage in 2 Peter is all about. People say, oh, Lord's never going to come back. All this time has passed. It wasn't too many years that had passed, really. I mean, think about it now. Now we're 2,000 years later. And someone might say today, you know, it's been 2,000 years since Jesus died on the cross and promised that he was going to come back one of these days. And 2,000 years, he's not coming back. Patience. To God, a day's like 1,000 years. 1,000 years like one day. And the story of Joseph helps us with that. All that he went through. But finally, after these years, 20 years later, now here are the brothers before him. And you know, it comes about. They're bowing down as we read it at verse 6 here again. And Joseph's brothers came and bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. That dream has been fulfilled. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. Where do you come from? He said. They said, and they said, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And Joseph recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. Is that surprising to anyone? That, you know, they right away he recognized them. Because first of all, you have to remember. How old was Joseph when he was thrown in a pit? 17 years old. When you're between 17 and 30, there's some change that goes on, isn't there? But you know, when you get a little bit older, then I mean, there's obviously changes that happen to our bodies all the time. We know that. But facial and that sort of thing, you can almost always. So there's some exceptions to this, but almost always you can recognize a fellow. I mean, when you know, between 30 and 50, there's not a whole lot of thing to the point where you don't recognize them. But and so he knows right away. He sees his brothers, and he knows, not only facially, but their language. They speak his language. Their attire, all of that, right away, he knows exactly who they are. But he's totally different. He was 17 last time they saw him. And so now he's at least 37, right? And probably, you know, I don't know exactly how many years into the famine we are now, but the famine has become severe so that people all over Canaan and Egypt are coming to him. So you would assume at least a couple of years into the second 7 years. But even if you take the most conservative position, he's at least 37. So these 20 years has passed, and he is shaven because he's, you know, he's now in power as a Egyptian power. He's obviously not an Egyptian, but he looks like them. He wears their attire. He speaks their language. And so they don't reckon. And then beside all that, he's in this great position of power. When we continue to read the narrative, it becomes clear that they kind of believe that he's probably dead. That Joseph is probably, he probably died as a slave in Egypt years ago. Last thing they expect is him to be second in command over all of Egypt. And they may not know that of this man right when they meet him, but they know he is somebody important. They don't expect that at all. So you add that to the fact that he's dressed like an Egyptian, he looks like one, he talks like one. They don't have a clue who he is, but he knows them right away. So go ahead, Dale, I'm sorry.
You just made the point. I'm
sorry. Okay, sorry about that. Now notice here, it says, and he was one who sold to all the, here's another thing to point out here. See where it says here, he was the one who sold all the people of the land, to all the people of the land. That's really not to be taken literally. Like it would be impossible. Remember, all of the people are coming from all over the civilized world that's affected by the famine in that overall region. All of Egypt and all of Canaan, all the various Canaanite people, Amorites and Hittites and everyone there, whoever's affected by the famine, they're coming because they have to survive. Egypt is the only place that has the food. And so they're coming. And there's no way that Joseph could literally be the one who is selling grain to all of these various people. The only thing this means is he's over the whole operation. Everybody is reporting to them. Remember, he has overseers and people in place to help him to do all of this. You remember in chapter 41, back in chapter 41 at verse 34, as he was giving the advice to Pharaoh, you recall, he says, "Let Pharaoh proceed to appoint overseers over the land, and take one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt and during the 7 plentiful years, and let them gather all of the food of these good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh for food in cities, and let them keep it." So that was a good plan. But the food, you got these storehouses of food, of grain, and they're in all of these cities around Egypt. So when people start coming, they go to the place, obviously, that's closest, probably. We're not told exactly how that works, but you have all of these different storehouses. And so Joseph had it set up so that these different places that sold, they'd have to report to him because he was the one in charge over the whole operation, but he's not the one actually doing every single transaction. That's just not feasible. It would have been impossible. And so why do I say all of that? Because this is another great example of the providence of God in all of this. He arranged it so that his brothers come to where he is. There's people coming all over to all of these different places, these different cities to buy, get grain. They come to Joseph. They end up before Joseph. That's the way it had to happen for all of this to play out. And that's exactly what happened because God's hand is all over this. And so they come to Joseph, but they don't know who he is, but he knows who they are. And so it's all playing out perfectly. And we're told here that he speaks rough to them. And he accuses them of being spies. And that has given some people some problem. Why in the world would he do that? Kaufman Commentaries, I think, is pretty good on this. Now, let me say before we read that in throughout this narrative and everything that's going on right now and will continue through the next few chapters, there's really no question in my mind, and I don't think in hardly anyone's mind, but that Joseph is testing his brothers and everything that he's doing. But that didn't really necessitate him accusing them, speaking roughly to them right at first. I mean, right from the start, he speaks roughly to them. And you think, well, you know, he's angry. All that they... No, Joseph really is not. We have seen every step of the way. He's not overcome with bitterness. And he is starting, I think Dale pointed out here a couple weeks ago, he's starting to figure out this whole thing, why everything is happening and that it is all a part of the providence of God to preserve his people. And Joseph's figuring this out. He's not angry with his brothers. And so the Kaufman Commentaries does pretty good with this. It may be wondered why Joseph charged his brothers with being spies. Some have charged Joseph with insincerity in this and have attempted to explain it in various ways. Perhaps a better explanation lies in the supposition that the case of his brothers had been brought before Joseph's personally by subordinates in the bureaucracy and that they had originated the charge of spying. In other words, it really wasn't Joseph who originally was accusing them of being spies. Some of these people who were under him brought these individuals to Joseph. Why would they do that? Because they would know that they were Hebrews. And for whatever reason, the Egyptians, they didn't really care for the Hebrews. We'll find out just a little bit later, they still can't even sit and eat with the Hebrews. To eat food with a Hebrew was an abomination. So, and they would recognize them as Hebrews, and of course they know the background of Joseph, and so they would arrange and that sort of explain, well, how is it that those brothers ended up exactly where Joseph was? Well, that would help explain that a little bit, wouldn't it? And so the subordinates are the one. And said this would account for two things. Number one, Joseph's handling the case in person. And number two, the firm, even harsh manner in which he dealt with it. Anything on Joseph's part that could have been interpreted by lesser officials as disloyal to Pharaoh would have been pounced upon and used by them against Joseph. For it may not be supposed for a moment that everyone in Egypt appreciated having this foreigner rule over them. Thus, Joseph discharged his duty under the circumstances to the fullest, openly backing up the false charges in a manner that left him above and beyond all possible criticism. And I don't know that Kaufman is right about that. Again, he even calls it supposition. But it would explain some things. Now, there's no question, again, that Joseph himself, he's going to be testing his brothers. And that he even uses the fact that they've been accused of being spies in his favor. Because he can figure out some things with this. But the reason he spoke so harshly to them is because they were brought to him by these subordinates who, again, aren't crazy about some foreigner ruling over them and might want to get Joseph in trouble. You know, I think Joseph was very popular with most. He saved the nation. But, you know, it is not far-fetched to think that there were some in Egypt that didn't appreciate a Hebrew who they couldn't even eat with being over them, being their ruler. And if they could set him up somehow. And Joseph, knowing that, he spoke harshly to his brother. What we'll find here just a little bit later on in this chapter, and this clearly is a situation where they're not alone. He's not alone with his brothers. But here down in this very chapter, he's going to be alone with them. And his tone towards them is completely different. He even shares with them, I fear your God. Because it's more of a private meeting. And so that would answer a few things as you stop and think of that. All right, well, going on. Again, it's at verse 9. And Joseph remembered the dreams that he had dreamed of them. And he said to them, you are spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land. And that's really referring to not the fruitfulness of the land. We know how that all went. But individuals coming in and trying to, you know, they're spying it out. You know, let's check this out and see what kind of military do they have? What kind of fortifications do they have? And, you know, are they vulnerable in any way? And it would make sense for the Egyptians to be a little suspicious of people coming from various places. It might very well be that spies would try to get in. They have no reason really to think that of Jacob's sons, but that's what they're charged with. You are spies. You've come in to see the nakedness of the land. And they said to him, no, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Your servants have never been spies. Was that accurate? I guess it all depends on how you look at it. In the context, it was accurate in what they meant by it. They were honest from the standpoint they weren't spies, were they? And Joseph knew they weren't spies. So they're honest or innocent with regard to that. Whether they were honest, really, the testing of these brothers that goes on in the next few chapters, that's what Joseph needs to get down to. You know, are these the same men who threw me in the pit? Do they have the same character or have they changed at all? And so he's going to be trying to determine that. But they right away said, no, we're honest men. He said, no, it is the nakedness of the land that you have come to see. And they said, we, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more. And so that gives him some information that I'm sure he appreciates. And we'll see. We'll probably save it for next week. But he right away kind of jumps on this. He and Joseph, we see this throughout. We've already seen it. But he's full of wisdom and he's quick of thought too. Like he can think things through. And we have some brethren here like that. I've always known brethren. Not like me. I had to think things through for you. Give me a few minutes to think about something. But some people can think right off the top of their head real fast. And Joseph seemed to be like that. He knew right away when they say who he is and they mention his younger brother, he comes up with a great way to determine whether or not everything is on the up and up. And that would be good news to him. I'm sure when he sees his 10 brothers, he probably wondered about Benjamin, because that was his only full brother. But he may have wondered, you know, what happened to my little brother here? Did y'all do to him what you did to me? Get rid of him? If Jacob showed any kind of favoritism, which we know he does, did you get rid of him just like you got rid of me? He doesn't know. But now, as he's questioning them, they start spilling things. That younger brother, back in Canaan with our father. And Joseph knows right away, I need to get him here. And so he goes about doing that. And we'll see how that develops on next week. And so we'll stop right there. And we'll pick up with that, see how he does that on next week.